Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing, following, and everything on social media and on your favorite podcast platform.
Yeah, everybody, thanks for being here. If it's your first time listening, really glad you found us. After you listen and you like what you hear, because we know you will, make sure to subscribe to us on YouTube, Instagram, on the Apple Podcast or whatever podcast platform you choose to use. We're available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, really all of them. If you type in They Had to Go Out, you're going to find us.
Yep, and theyhadtogooout.com's now got like really, really good link. I don't know. It looks pretty sweet, I think.
It's a good website. Do you know a guy who did it, Phil?
I do, right? Man. He streamlined the crap out of that right thing. And but if you haven't got a chance to check it out, just theyhadtogooout.com, and it'll get you where you need to go to listen. Today, we've got an awesome one. So I'm, you know, I troll like social media to find guests, and happened to see Miss Ashley Leppert pop up with a brand new book called The Hurricane Within, and start searching around, kind of read the background on it, and we've got an epic story for you today, I think. So who we have on the line? Miss Ashley Leppert, born in Detroit, Michigan, also raised there, joined the Coast Guard back in October of 2005. Went to boot camp with Recruit Company Uniform 172. First assignment was the non-rate staff down at beautiful Sector San Juan, where the drinking age was 18. So I'm sure she had a great time.
I'm amazed she ever went past non-rate.
Right. I went from there to Air Station Bordequin, where she entered the airman program back when they still had it. Went from there to I think it's Aviation Electronics Technician A School out in East City. Some things happen. We, you know, plans change. She ends up at Station St. Indigo's. I don't even know. Where was that, Bill?
It's Southern Maryland. It's on the Potomac River, near the mouth of the Potomac.
So it's not on the shore. It's on
it's
the inside.
No, it's Potomac River.
Okay. So heads to Station St. Indigo's, you know, gets called there, goes back into the airman program down at Air Station East City, gets orders again to AET A School, graduated with class 5109. And went to her first operational air station out in Detroit, spent 5 years there, transferred down to Air Station New Orleans, and crazy, was medically retired 1 week ago, and now we've got her on the show. So really awesome turnaround.
It just shows what a big deal we are.
That's what it is. That's exactly what it was. No, but we really thank her for joining us, and I'm going to have Bill go ahead and ask the question.
Ashley, how's it going? That's not the question.
Hey, guys. How are you doing? Hey, guys. I'm awesome. How are you?
We're having fun here. That's what we do.
So heck yeah.
Question as always, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Oh, man. Okay. So I have quite a few that I could think of off the top of my head. Obviously, flying in the middle of a hurricane makes things a little dangerous.
Just a tad.
Yeah, just a tad. I would have to say probably day two of flying in Hurricane Harvey. I was with my buddy Troy, was my rescue swimmer, and we had just done about two or three patterns looking for some people, and we found a huge spot of people right there in the cul-de-sac of looks like kind of like an apartment complex or a subdivision. And we tell the pilots what we see. I lower the rescue swimmer down, and we're packing all these people. Most of them are children with different like medical conditions. It seemed like it was like a feeding tube with one kid, and then another kid had a bunch of medicine, and so it was just high intensity, just knowing that, you know, these kids are already struggling with their certain illnesses.
Were you at a hospital, Ashley, or where was it?
No, this was just in like a I guess it was just a subdivision.
It
was
really, you said, weird. A cul-de-sac, yeah. Right? Yeah, so just,
yeah.
Like, man, what a, yeah, that's a,
yeah, so yeah, but anyway, so, absolutely, it was crazy, and obviously high intensity, you know, with the weather kicking up. And
hey, but before we get too far into the drama, and I just want to, like, for people want to have background, right? Hurricane Harvey, tell us kind of where you were, what category hurricane it was, and what air station you were assigned to.
Sure, absolutely. So at the time, I was in Air Station New Orleans. We had already sent one crew out to kind of station there in Houston. Hurricane Harvey, I believe at landfall, was a Hurricane 4 condition, or a Hurricane Category 4. But the difference with that is typically when the hurricanes reach land, they kind of lose a little bit of strength and then they keep moving on. Well, for this one, it kind of just stayed stationary. And so the rain and the flooding became a huge issue as opposed to the rain. So I was actually on backup duty, which means that I was kind of just on standby. And I honestly didn't really think I was going to get called out. But that morning at like 3 in the morning, my commanding officer called me and he said that I was getting recalled out there. So we headed over there, of course. The flight out was pretty crazy because the weather was intense the second we pretty much left New Orleans.
Ashley, I'm going to ask one more question.
Sure.
What does an AET do?
So
and that, hey, that's a legit question. I have no idea. I honestly don't know.
You didn't mean that to be funny, but it's kind of funny.
Yeah, no, I just really, like, I truly, I mean, I get the title, right? But what, like, you say that you were called out. Is there a specific sorties that have to have AETs on board? Do you, you know, what do you guys do?
Yeah, no, it's all good. So it's a mouthful, but it's an avionics electrical technician. And basically,
I was way off.
Basically, what that job entails is anything that is communications, navigation, anything that has a wire or a black electrical box connected to it. My job is basically, I'm in charge of those components. We do troubleshooting. We do routine maintenance just to keep everything running properly for the pilots. And so every time a crew flies anywhere, they have to have a flight mechanic, not necessarily an AET. It could be an AMT, but you have to have one flight mechanic who is qualified to operate the hoist and do all the jobs that and flight mechanic would have to do.
Cool, gotcha. So like if you see a flight mech, it could be an AET or an AMT.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Gotcha. That makes perfect sense now. Man, the AMTs have that lone lock because I thought they were all AMTs.
Oh
yeah, no.
Yeah. AMTs make, yeah. I'm not even gonna say it. I was gonna make a joke. I'm not gonna make it.
Yeah, be nice.
What is it? They make the helos, like, nah, no, you can't do it.
With that being said, what airframe are you guys flying on this?
So we, at Air Station New Orleans, we were equipped with 5 MH-65 Dolphins. Mm. So they're short-range recovery, so typically with one fill-up of gas, we can fly approximately 2.5 hours, give or take.
My experience on the Cutter was they could fly for about 5 minutes before they had to come back. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, that's probably because they were just sick of looking out at the ocean water, and they were ready to get back on that gorgeous Cutter.
Mm, yeah, it was beautiful. I painted it myself.
What do they call that? They say they're underpowered, but there's like some thing when they're hoisting, like their power to weight ratio or something.
I have no idea.
We've had like 3 guests.
That's a question for the AET, not for the other bosun mate.
Yeah, it's secret squirrel stuff. We can't tell you all
about
that.
Okay, that's what it is. Fair enough. Now that we're on the AET topic,
let's go down this road.
We just got to go down it. Like, are AETs nerds? I just you know, are you guys really incredibly smart? What's your ASVAB score? Is it a highly technical job?
We're pretty nerdy. I would say the majority of us have, like, a video game or a computer type of, I don't know, I can't even get my words out. But most of us are nerds. Either we're gamers or we like to, like, read a lot or, I don't know. I don't really fit the bill, but...
I was going to say, I knew you when you were at Station San Inigo's, and how'd you end up doing this right then?
It's kind of odd. I don't know. I knew I joined the Coast Guard wanting to be in aviation, had a couple of hiccups, and I was like, you know what? I got to go for it. So, I mean, every time I get up in a helicopter, I'm just like, I feel at home. This is where it's at.
I think there needs to be like an OSAT, like gamer match or something, just for, because I bet you guys would mop the floor with the OSs.
Every episode, OSs come up.
I know. I can't help it.
We love you guys.
I'm just thinking like the AATs are out flying and then you got the other option. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
sorry. We're all thinking.
We got that out of the way. We got that out of the way. All right, let's get back to the drama.
Yep. So sorry. So we're in the cul-de-sac. A lot of children are having obvious medical concerns, and you guys have lowered down, right?
Yeah. So at this point in the rescues, we were pretty much only getting people that were severely injured or had medical issues where they had to get to a hospital immediately. So.
And the storm's still ongoing, right? Like you said the weather was deteriorating. So are you pre-storm or is the storm already passed or is it over?
It's pretty much sitting right on top of us. Yeah. I think if I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure it sat over us for like a solid 2 days.
I was going to say, that thing just sat and dumped rain on Houston for 2 or 3 days, right? That was the one they got like 50 plus inches of rain from?
Yes, it was gnarly. It just rained and rained and rained. And then I think finally after being there for, I want to say, 4 days, it kind of slowed up and the rain finally stopped. But the flooding still continued. But yeah, so anyways, I mean, I lower my rescue swimmer. We have rain whipping in the cabin. We're talking to him on the swimmer radio that they carried down. And I'm telling him from our pilots, like, hey, we can only get the most critically injured. And he was just responding and was like, there's a ton of kids down here. We need to get, like, pretty much everybody down here out. So, of course, you know, we're on high panic and a little more alert than before. And I start hoisting one after another, and you know, it's little kids, and you know, like I said, most of them had health issues, but before I know it, there was probably like at least 10 to 12 people inside the cabin. And if you've been inside of a helicopter or those, especially the MH-65s, you know how tiny that cabin space is. So we were just putting people in every free space that we could. And then finally, the very last hoist, there was a woman, and I look down and I see Troy putting bags, which I thought at the time were like clothes, with her. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what is he doing? Like, this lady can't take her clothes with her. Like, we're short on fuel. We're short on space. Like, you know, it has to be just the essentials. And, you know, but anyways, I'm like, all right, he knows what he's doing. I trust him. I just hoisted this woman up with these like 5 bundles with her in the basket. And I get her in the cabin, and then I lower the hook down because we just had enough time to get him back in the cabin, Troy. And finally, once we're taking off and going to the landing zone to drop the patients off, I look at the basket and I realize, unfolding one bundle at a time, all of those bundles that I had thought were clothes were actually all little babies wrapped up in blankets that were needing medical assistance. So.
And she carried them all up in the basket that you were hoisting, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unreal. Wow.
It was intense. And at one point I looked down and like all 4 of sets of their eyes were staring at me. And it just was this moment that was like forever ingrained into my brain. Like, wow. Like it hits you at that moment, like just how desperate these people are and how, you know, scary this whole situation was, not just for them, but for us too.
Yeah, that sounds like one of those "this is why I joined the Coast Guard" kind of moments.
Oh, for sure. I get goosebumps just talking about it now.
Yeah, dude, I got them too, just like hearing it. I mean, I have a question though. Like, if so, had Troy, your rescue swimmer, if he would have said like, "Hey, I've got a mom with her 5 kids, right, and they're all bundled up, and they're going to be your next hoist," do you think that would have changed anything that you did when you hoisted her up?
No, I think it would have went pretty much the same. I did forget to mention this one part. We were having not just our aircraft, but a bunch of aircraft throughout the entire time. We were having a lot of water intrusion into the cabin, so it was affecting our ability to communicate through the internal communication system. So,
oh man, those AETs just not doing their job.
You need to solder those connections better. Yep.
Right. But yeah, so I think it kind of messed up our line of communication there for a while. So for the most part, I don't think I was able to talk to him on his Rescue Summer radio after a while. So I'm sure he probably tried to tell me, you know, what was happening, but I, you know, it was just kind of like go time at that point.
Yeah, and you guys just use hand signals for the most part, right? Is that the...
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the hoist? What do? Like, you just, like... make a little circle with your finger? Is that, I don't know, so what do you do?
You're well, running a so crane right now.
We just smile really big at one another, like, hey, you good? I'm good. Are you good? Yep, we're good. Let's go. No.
Oh, that's it. Like,
no, it's the Coast Guard. You know it's more complicated than that. Come on.
No, pretty much the proper protocol and the terminology used is when the rescue swimmer has the survivor in the basket, he gives me a thumbs up, which means that signals to me that I'm prepared to take the load, and I let the pilots know that I'm doing that. It's just, as a flight mechanic, you pretty much are the middleman of communication between the pilot who can't see what's going on down below and the rescue swimmer who's, you know, actually in the mix of it doing all the work down there, so...
Question for you, actually. When you guys were, you're deployed for Hurricane, I know a lot of times we kind of end up taking crews from all over the place and putting them there. Were these all people, like, you had worked with before, or was this, like, a mixed bag kind of crew? Did you know everybody, or was this, like, first time flying together kind of thing?
Yes, so actually at this point it was a mixed bag crew. That's the great thing about Coast Guard Aviation is that we all train the same. So, you know, you can pull pilots and rescue swimmers and flight mechanics from any air station and put them in the same helicopter and it should go, you know, smooth and without any problems because we all train the same. So this time, funny enough, I actually was stationed with Troy Ramsdell in Detroit. So when all these people came from all over the place, the one kind of silver lining in the whole Hurricane Harvey thing was it was like a little reunion because we're like, oh, hey, man, I haven't seen you in forever. And then, you know, so when we got put on the same crew, it was super exciting because I trained with him when he was a brand new rescue swimmer. So we had that rapport already. And it was really cool just to be able to go out there and, you know, fly again together.
All right. What about the pilots? Were they people you'd flown with before or was this like first time with them?
Nope, the first time with them, that was Lieutenant Briggs and Lieutenant Bucata, and they were, I believe they were both from Corpus Christi, but I had never flown with them. I mean, the first time I met them was when we sat down and did the pre-flight brief.
So I always hear, like, you always hear the relationship between the swimmer and the flight mech, right? Like, it seems like you guys get pretty close.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the pilots, though, being, like, commissioned officers, I get that there's, like, I don't know, what are the relationship differences? Like, are you guys, you hang out on the off days, or how does that work?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I can speak for most Coast Guard aviators, but, like, when you fly in the helicopter together, you have to have such a trust in everybody's job and their ability to perform. So there's really, it's kind of like a family. Like, it's kind of like the mom and dad up front driving the car and the brother and the sister or, you know, whatever in the back seat, like goofing off and just, you know what I mean? It's just a real family kind of feel to it. And it has to be because, you know, if my swimmer messes up, my life is on the line. If I mess up, you know, I put my pilots and my swimmer at risk. So, you know, you have to have that close-knit and that comfort and that, you know, just that good relationship.
I just see every time that I see AET now, I'm going to just think, are we there yet? Are we
right.
there yet? Are we there yet?
So, yes, exactly.
Actually, question for you to kind of piggyback on what Phil said, and I know you're a good person to answer this because, again, I did know you when you were at Station San Inigo's and you were a, you know, qualified boat crewman, and I know you went out on a lot of cases. Kind of compare your – what it's like, you know, kind of being on a boat crew versus being part of an air crew. And remember, you're talking to two bosun mates at the same time.
I know. I have to tread lightly with my answer here.
No, give us an honest, because I'm always curious, you know, and you're somebody who has done both of them. And you did a good bit at the station. I know that for sure. So you can answer this question, I think.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I maybe I actually made not the best person to ask because I feel like I got along with everybody, and I kind of just, you know, I feel like for me, I treated people with respect, and I got that in return. But as far as the defining line between being on a boat crew and being on an, you know, aviation crew, for me, it was kind of like night and day, because I know you guys know the old saying, there's more, what is it? Something about
there's more planes in the ocean than there are boats in the sky.
Yes. Okay. So you knew where I was going. That. See, nailed it. UBMs are smarter than I thought.
I'll tell you what. Oh, there we go. She had to get it in. Fair enough.
I think the bar was really low there, though.
No, but like for me, it's just, again, I reiterate the fact that, like, you know, when you're flying, it is like one false move, like lives are on the line. And like when you're on a boat, you know, it's a lot less, I don't want to say a lot less camaraderie, because I always felt that, but you guys know where I'm going with that. Like, I just feel like in aviation, it's a little bit more of a tight-knit community. We rely on each other a lot more. And if you make a mistake on a boat, you know, with, you know, you're just going to chug along with one engine instead of two, as opposed to in aviation, that's a lot more detrimental if someone makes a mistake. So therefore, you know, we do hang out on the off times. I mean, yeah, it's still when you walk past an officer, you still salute and have respect, but you can walk up to him and be like, hey, sir or ma'am, like, what's up? Like, talk, you know, and I feel like it's a little more of an easy feeling as opposed to the boat life when it was a little more, I guess, rigid. I don't know.
Yeah, if somebody asked me if we were there yet, I'd have shut that down real fast.
Right.
No, very cool. So, Hurricane Harvey, how many rescues did you have? Or like your air crew, I guess I should say.
Don't ask her to give away the whole book, though. People still
have to buy it. I mean, hey, maybe that's it. I wish I had it in front of me. I don't have it right now. Cool thing, Ashley sent me a signed copy. If you guys, you know, buy your own, maybe she'll sign yours, too. Just throwing it out there.
Heck yeah. I will be completely honest with you. I have like an estimate number. I haven't really sat down. It was such a fast moving pace that you didn't really sit down and say, okay, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, I didn't really count people. I know it's in the vicinity of somewhere around 50 to 60 people that we hoisted between. And I'll clarify too, I was also on 3 different flight crews for 3 different flying days. So that's cumulative over, you know, those 3 days of flying.
Right, right.
But somewhere in the vicinity. And again, like, I don't know. I don't think it's kind of like one of those things you go through and just say, I want to count and see how many people I saved. It's just like awesome. We all went out.
Yeah, it was just one of those major days, right? I mean, it's just a 3-day whirlwind, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And like I was telling you with my story, just that one hoisting evolution alone, I think we had not, or including our crew, we had like 17 or 18 people in the cabin. So, I mean, that was just one.
I have no idea how you fit that many people in a 65. I've been on one, and there's zero. Like, you put me in one, and there's no room left.
Yeah, there it's, you know, and I'm like 5'10", so it's crammed in there, that's for sure.
How do you control the kids when they're all up there? So these are all, you know, obviously you got infants, I'm assuming, probably some toddlers, little kids that don't behave well. Are they, like, is everybody getting hoisted up with this giant smile on their face, like, I get to ride in a helicopter today, or are they acting crazy on the ride to the landing zone? How's that going?
Well, I think, you know, these poor kids, like, they were shocked, you know. I mean, typically had it been under different circumstances, I'm sure they would have been like, heck yeah, helicopter.
Right.
But, I mean, they were, the terror, it was just pure terror on their face. And most of the little kids that we hoisted up all had a parent with them, except for one little boy. I remember I hoisted him up by himself. But the majority of people we did have, you know, either had a parent with them that was holding him in the back. So they kind of were just kind of like, what is going on kind of thing, you know?
And talk to me about the, when you're talking to the pilots, right, and you're kind of giving them this direction, and the swimmers down below, how does that communication go too? Is the pilot's job pretty easy as far as just maintaining station, and then you and the swimmer just reacting to the hoist? I mean, everything I've seen on a boat, and granted, we're moving like 30 degrees off the swell or whatever, off the wind. When you're doing these kind of, you know, in the middle of the hurricane hoist, how much effort, how much communication is it taking between you and the pilot just to get him to maintain station?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, honestly, it is from the beginning of the evolution when we do what's called like we'll do a flyby or just a pass through and look at our hoisting area. We'll look at winds. We'll see where our flyout is going to be if we need to, if we lose an engine while we're hoisting or something and we need to fly out. So it's a lot of, there's a lot of pre-staging and pre-planning before we even get to the hoisting evolution. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, as a flight mechanic, you're pretty much the middleman between the communication between the rescue swimmer and the pilot. So the pilot, you know, they have to maintain a good position, and they just have to listen to my commands if I see them drifting forward or aft or left or right. And I pretty much communicate. So I'm on what's called internal communication system. So we all have ICS, and so we have the ability to talk to one another. And so we kind of have an idea of what the evolution is going to be like when I lower the rescue swimmer. But then once the rescue swimmer is down there and he's, you know, putting people in the basket or assessing a patient, he'll communicate through his mic. But like I said, at that time, there was a lot of issues with the water, you know, messing up our mic and our communication abilities.
And you're just saying left, right, forward, back. Is that, are those the commands of the pilot, or the commands, the terms that you would use? How do you communicate it specifically?
So specifically, once I'm on ICS, I'll say, you know, something like rescue check part two complete, and the pilot will say, Roger, go ahead, con me in. At which point, I will con the pilot in and say, you know, forward right 20, forward right 30, for, you know, I'll give him a conning command as to where I need him to be. And then once he's in position, I'll just say hold position, lowering the swimmer, rescue swimmer's halfway down, rescue swimmer's on deck, waiting for the ready for pickup. And then I just kind of keep the pilot in that steady position. I'm watching the rescue swimmer, waiting for him to give me the thumbs up once the patient's in the basket. And then once, you know, he's in the basket, the rescue swimmer gives me the thumbs up, at which point, you know, I say, patients prepared for, or survivors ready for pickup, and then prepared to take the load, and then taking the load, which means the patient's off the deck. And then I con the pilot where he needs to go. So it's a lot of like little, you know, talking points, you know, hold position, forward, right, whatever, you know, distance.
Ashley, you totally could have passed the stand drill, I think, right there. Yeah. It's been a week. You've been retired a week, but I'm pretty sure you walked us all through that thing exactly. That was awesome.
Oh, thanks. I'm sure I messed up a few things, but I'm getting rusty in my old age, you know.
Do they teach you to be a flight mech at AET school?
No, actually in AET school, it's just kind of generic and general avionics. So we learn about, you know, fuses and circuit breakers and wires and all that jazz. And then once we actually get to our air station, that's when we learn how to become a qualified. First, you become a qualified basic air crewman. And then after basic air crewman, you become a flight mechanic.
Yeah, that's what I kind of learned that about the swimmers.
And those like basic air crew and flight mechanic, that's like platform or airframe specific, right? Like just because you're a flight mech on a 65 doesn't mean you're a flight mech on a 60. Kind of like us in the boat crew world. Like just because I'm a crewman on a RBS doesn't mean I'm a crewman on an RBM, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm pretty sure for swimmers, they are qualified on every platform, I believe, once they get their qualification. But yes, for flight mechanics, once we're qualified on that airframe, it stays that airframe unless we switch to a different one.
Right.
Yeah, swimmers are weird, though, because they go to
just
A
stop
school.
There. But swimmers then they are have weird. Just stop
rescue
there.
Swimmer school. I never understand it. I still don't get it.
They get lowered out of hell.
No, I know. It's just
they just stop it. Swimmers are weird, and everybody knows what we mean.
So one day somebody's going to explain to me the difference between like ASTA school and rescue swimmer school, because they're
today is not the day.
Very interesting. Yeah. So what else happened in Harvey? Anything? Any other crazy hoists or crazy sights and sounds?
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum. And that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. Sounds?
Oh, man. Like, the whole 4 days I was there was crazy. I mean, there was a lot of crazy hoists. I hoisted up one lady who was seizuring really, really bad, and I thought she was in a seizure out of the basket at one point. Nate Pesky was my rescue swimmer, and he was just doing a stellar job down there with, like, putting her in the basket because she was seizuring. The very first day, me and my rescue swimmer, we rescued a pregnant lady who was stuck in an apartment complex, so we had to land in a parking lot and, you know, get all the way to her apartment complex, bring her to the aircraft to be airlifted to a hospital. It was pure chaos for, you know, those 4 days. And it was just, I just remember being constantly cold and wet because your flight suit never had the time to dry out and your feet were soaked in those boots. And yeah, it was just, it was gnarly. But you know what? I know any of us that were out there would do it all over again for the sake of, you know, saving people.
For sure. And what, you know, after the fact, I'm assuming, so I kind of read, you know, I read the description of your book and that you learned some lessons there. I'm sure you guys saw things that you didn't want to see, right? That nobody wants to see or hopes they never have to. Were there any support afterwards that was provided to you guys or to the air crews in general?
Yeah, I think, I know for me and I know a couple other people, it was pretty hard afterwards, seeing a couple things that we all saw out there. But, you know, the command was phenomenal. The second we all got back to the air station, we all had, I forget the actual name of the training, but we had this wonderful... Yes, thank you. Sorry, yes. So we had SISM and we sat there, and which was great. But, you know, a bunch of us would get together and go get dinner, go have a couple beers and just talk about things that we went through. And I think that helped me heal a lot, just knowing that what I was feeling and what I was going through, you know, my shipmates were as well. So it was cool to just be able to, you know, reflect and kind of process some of those traumatic things together.
Right, for sure. That's why SISM always seemed like a good thing, especially for new people, to actually get somebody to talk, I guess. Right. Like, at least someone's going to talk, more than likely. It's always got to be the senior guy, though, it seems like.
I think we hear that a lot, though, from people who've kind of been through one of these, you know, big deal, probably... It's emotional, right? It's what do they call it? A significant emotional event. That the SISM training is awesome, and the Coast Guard absolutely needs to continue providing that. But it ends up being that personal support network that you've built over time, and just talking to your peers and your friends, that seems to be the most helpful thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, for me, I had an amazing family, an amazing support system with friends, but it's a whole different story when you're talking to people that have actually been there and can truly understand what you're talking about, what you're seeing, because friends and family, they just want to be there for you, which is awesome, but they don't really get it too. Right. So that's why the Coast Guard support that I had from the air station and my fellow Coasties that were out there with me, that was, I mean, immeasurable. That was definitely a huge reason why I was able to get through some of those emotions. And for me, like, it's like, oh, I got this, I'm good, no, I don't need to talk to anybody, I'm fine, I just did my job, I'm good. And then, you know, you start having some nightmares about some things, or, you know, it's hard for you to talk about some things, and then you're like, all right, whatever, okay, maybe I'll go talk to somebody.
Right.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, I've seen guys have been doing it for 20 years all of a sudden just break down, and you're like, what, you know, what just happened? I don't even know.
Yeah.
It's something that happened, you know, years ago, and then those stories start coming out. I think that's good for, especially for junior people to hear, because you have to talk about it. Otherwise, Absolutely. It's going to come back and haunt you.
Right on. No, for sure. And there's no shame in it. I mean,
no, heck no.
And it's like, hey, you see some stuff that sucks. So it's better to talk about it and deal with it and heal from it than keep it all in. And then, you know, down the road, 5, 10, 20 years, you know, you have a mental breakdown because you haven't processed or dealt with some, you know, terrible things. So,
yeah. And I'll tell you, if you see one of your crewmen, like fellow crewmen, like crying or, you know, has an emotional response to it, I mean, nobody's making fun of that. Like, that's something that you're there. You just want to help, right? Like, what can I do to help you right now?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what lessons did you take from the response to Harvey?
There's so many. It really gave me a perspective of appreciation. You know, you take for granted the little things, like having warm, clean, dry socks to put on your feet, or, you know, having food to eat, because I think a lot of people fail to realize too, like during the hurricane stuff, I mean, we were also like stranded at the air station. We also really didn't have a ton of food or stuff like that in the beginning, until, you know, the donations and all that came in, which was awesome. But I mean, we anyways, I digress. My point is it gave me a newfound appreciation, like, not to sweat the small stuff and to appreciate, you know, those little things in life, being able to put on fresh clothes and have a hot shower and have a hot meal. And, you know, the other stuff, you know, just, it doesn't matter. Those other issues that people worry about sometimes, it's like, nah, it doesn't really matter to me anymore. I'm just thankful. I wake up every day blessed and thankful. And that's my biggest takeaway.
I like it. That's, you know, one thing I'd ask you if you noticed it. I was, any disaster zone you go in, it's like how fragile the system is.
Right.
Right? Within, you know, one single storm for a couple of hours can just decimate the system. And now you're left with, you know, hopefully a lot of good people and not so many bad, or not so many panicky at least. And yeah, it's a very fragile system.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Okay, let's go to first SAR case as a member of an air crew.
Ooh, okay. So I have a pretty rad story. So I, back in 2010, it was my senior chief was looking for a basic air crew member to go down to Guantanamo Bay for, we do our aviation detachment. So every winter we would send an air crew down and hop on the back of a cutter and do, you know, law enforcement and drug interdiction and all that good stuff. So nobody really wanted to go over December and miss out on holiday routine and all that good jazz. So for me, you know, my father had just passed away that June, so I was like kind of looking to get away for the holidays, and so I volunteered to go, brand new. I think I was like basic air crew qualified for maybe a month, and so I'm down there, and it's a beautiful flight. We're flying over the Caribbean and all that jazz, and so we land on the back of the cutter, and it's our first night there, or first or second night, and we get launched on a possible semi-submersible drug boat. So I'm like, this is awesome. I'm like, let's go look for it. So we're on our pattern and we spot them. And it's about, I think it's like dusk at this point. So we're flying over, and it actually turned out not to be a semi-submersible. It was just a go fast, which is just a, you know, a power boat. And so we find this drug boat, and we're hovering over it, like flying over it, you know, trying to get it to stop. And these two guys are like holding onto the engines because they thought that we're going to shoot out the engines. But little did they know we didn't have a gun on board. But so anyways, we get over, and they're not stopping. So I was able to like throw message blocks down at them that said stop. And just, I mean, hovering over a drug boat in the middle of the Caribbean in itself was just insane to me. After a month of being qualified, I was like, I can't believe this is happening. But yeah, so it wasn't really a search and rescue case, but it ended up being the boat's first drug bust. And we were able to get the small boat launched from the cutter, and they ended up coming over to the boat, and I was watching on my night vision goggles at that point of them throwing, you know, bales of cocaine over the boat and stuff. So it was pretty gnarly.
That
was
very cool. Yeah, and people forget that the helos do that sometimes, at least. Right. And I'm sure, you know, everybody sees them in the search and rescue light, but yeah, there's a whole nother mission set there.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're kind of like the jack of all trades. We have a bunch of missions we go out and do.
Did the message block say Alto Subarco Ahura?
Yep, it sure did.
All right.
It sure did.
Just guessing.
And guess what? I threw it and it landed right in the middle of that boat. I was like, dang.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that again if you tried.
Right.
No, you couldn't pay me to do that again.
Man, if only you guys had gotten that on video.
Right. It probably is.
I know, right?
Yeah, it probably is. Yeah. That's awesome.
What's first or best SAR case you had, if you had any, at the station as a boat crewman?
Well, first, what boats were you qualified on?
So I was engineer qualified on the 25s and the 41s.
Oh, you were an engineer for us. So, I mean, this is what you wanted to do. You wanted to be.
Yeah, you were
a
fireman, right?
Yes, I was.
Yeah. I thought so.
Yeah, so I honestly, I don't recall many of the details because that was, 2008, I think?
Yeah,
that
sounds right. Probably eight to nine, something like that.
Yeah.
Get out of here. We've had guys that were in the Coast Guard back in the 30s on here telling us about, you know, all kinds of craziness.
Well, I didn't really do a whole lot because I don't know. I think I stood a lot of whatever the one is where you stand at the comm center desk. I did a lot of that duty as opposed to anything cool, I think, because, you know, I had come from A school, and as an aviator, they didn't like me a whole lot at the beginning, so I stood a lot of duty, but I do remember there being one crazy case where there was a big, huge tanker or something like that. And like there was like a female pilot who was like taken captive by the drunk Russians who had a bunch of vodka on board or something like that. Do you remember that one?
I don't remember that one.
What an awesome start to a story.
I was probably busy kicking osprey nests off of AIDS the Navigation. I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah. Have you ever seen, what's that old Coast Guard movie, the black and white one? Have you ever seen it?
I haven't seen it.
Man, it sounds just like that. Except they would have been in Alaska. But
right.
Yeah,
either way, yeah. It's a completely believable story, so just make it up from here.
Yeah, that's pretty much all I remember because I wasn't a part of it. But I stood the watch as they were calling and all the crazy stuff that were happening, and I had to relay it to like the police that were on base. So I was a big part of it, but not actually out on the water as a part of it. Because I was only there for about a year or less than a year, so I didn't really get a whole lot of search and rescue cases out there, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't, as I recall, it's not a super busy station with SAR.
Yeah, no, definitely not.
So what about Air Station Detroit? Did you ever get into the, I mean, you were there for 5 years, so you definitely did a few winters.
Oh, yeah. You know, I love me some Detroit winters. I know I'm crazy.
Yeah, you are crazy. I don't even know how to respond to that.
I mean, I'm a little partial. I got love for my Detroit city, so I'll deal with the winters. I'll take the Detroit winters over the New Orleans summers, though. I can't stand the heat down there.
I couldn't agree with you more.
I'd still be south of I-10 if it was me.
No, yeah, we're all different people, Phil.
Right, yeah. No one's got no heart, but... So, yeah, no, when I was in Detroit, I had a couple good cases. Once again, my swimmer, Nate Feske, who was also down during Hurricane Harvey with me, him and I rescued a kayaker who was attempting to kayak from one side of Lake Michigan to the other. So we had saved him because the waves were getting pretty gnarly out there, I think like 4 to 6 feet in Lake Michigan, which was crazy.
Yeah, that doesn't happen for anybody that was like, oh, 4 to 6 feet. Like 4 to 6 feet in Lake Michigan or any of the Great Lakes is a substantial 4 to 6 feet. And there are no backs to those waves, and they just keep coming.
They pound you. And especially if you're in a kayak, like this poor guy, we pull up on scene, and this poor guy is just pale white. And he had been throwing up and dehydrated. And, you know, I will say he did have his PLB, you know, his personal locating beacon, so that's exactly what saved his life, so at least he thought it through enough to bring that with him. But yeah, that poor guy was in bad shape.
Do you guys have a DF on the 65s?
Yep, sure do.
Oh yeah, you guys can DF, who knew?
Huh. Absolutely, yeah, we use that a lot when we're out there pinging off for the PLBs.
It's good to know. So you're telling me I should invest like $200 to get my own PLB just in case, yeah.
Yes, okay. Everybody should. Yes. Everybody should.
Well, Ashley, talk to us about the book. So why did you choose to write it and kind of what's the message that you're trying to push with it? Or the story you want to tell, I guess.
Okay, yeah, no, right on. So I wrote the book for a lot of different reasons. You know, primarily I wanted to inform the public about what Coast Guard Aviation is all about and more specifically what a flight mechanic does. I also wanted to just kind of help other people who have been through similar things in my story. You know, I talk a lot about my personal life, and so I just hope to help and inspire somebody else, you know, deal with their issues in their life. And also, you know, going through, you know, I was medically retired from the Coast Guard, and, you know, when you're active duty for that long and all of a sudden you are taken out of doing your job that you love so much, you know, it's really hard to deal with the day to day. So it became sort of a form of therapy for me. I had an amazing friend, Katie, who helped me with, you know, get the story on paper and just, you know, articulate my thoughts. And so, yeah, I mean, I just basically wanted to get my story out. You know, everybody else had their story as to what I was going through and what I did out for the hurricanes and all, you know, basically everything about my life. So it was kind of validation for me to be able to, you know, tell my story and my truth and hopefully inspire others.
Awesome. I can't wait to read it, to be honest. Yeah, it's going to be very cool. What what's the biggest takeaway that somebody could expect from reading it?
Well, for me, I talk a lot about God and how, you know, my faith has gotten me through, everything in my life personally. So I would say that's probably a huge takeaway. But on top of that, I hope somebody gets done reading my story and they're like, oh, wow, okay, so that's what the Coast Guard does, or that's what, you know, these Coast Guard aviators do during the hurricanes, or, you know, whatever the case may be. I hope it's just like a learning thing for somebody.
You just schooled two old bosun mates on what an AET was. I didn't even know the title. Did you? You had no idea what that
was. No, because we had Hitron on the cutter all the time.
What's AET?
Something, something technician.
Uh-huh, yep, see?
I know what they do.
Avionics, electronics technician, right?
Yep, yeah, you got it.
Look at that. See, learn something today. Learn today. Love it. And then I know, too, Ashley, you started your own publishing company, too, right?
Yes, I did. So I don't really know what my next steps in life are going to be, but I've been doing a lot of traveling in my RV, so I might be putting together another book in the near future. So it's cool. I have Mandy Pants LLC, Mandy Pants Press, which is my dog. So I'm super dog mom here with my publishing company.
Is it going to be like a Detroit travel guide? Tell me it is. I'm going to get it for Bill for Christmas since he loves it up there.
Right? Where not to go.
Right? Here you go, guys. That's awesome. Well, hey, you know, I know we talked about kind of personal struggles before we started. Let's go through it maybe a little bit. I think a lot of people struggle with kind of what you struggle with, especially being younger.
Yes.
You know, I wouldn't call it substance abuse necessarily. I guess it is abuse, but not alcohol dependence or anything else. And I think I know a lot of people struggle with that, myself included at one time. So what, what kind of changed your outlook?
Kind of going back to, you know, the whole dealing with problems in your life thing, like after you get back from a hurricane, kind of talking about it. I used alcohol in, you know, my early 20s and stuff to deal with things in my life that I didn't deal with. It was, you know, I think just for most people who abuse alcohol, you know, it kind of is a band-aid for, you know, their feelings. And if they drink and they feel great, then they're not thinking about anything that could have happened to them in their life prior to that. So, you know, for me, I learned the hard way by getting a DUI and realizing, okay, I didn't want to make my mistake define who I was. So I took that as, okay, you know what? I made a mistake. I'm going to lick my wounds and move forward. And from there on out, you know, I still drink, don't get me wrong, but I know how to be responsible now about it instead of, you know, abusing it to kind of, make myself feel better.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it, I think. You know, what I always thought too, and what I kind of tell younger guys is the public service is a privilege, right? So if you want the privilege of being among us, you know, you got to play by the rules.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, that's kind of what I always thought was if you want the privilege of public service, there's a sacrifice that you have to make. And that's one of them. Many sacrifices, I guess, you have to make, but that's definitely one. No, very
absolutely
cool.
Yeah, and if you're, you know, if you're out there in any type of first responder work or, you know, serving the public, like you said, you know, don't you want to be in a clear mind? Don't you want to be out there on your A game? Because if you're not and you do make a mistake, you know, that's going to haunt you for the rest of your life. So that's kind of how I think about that as well.
Yeah, and I think pretty much every topic that you touched on today is all kind of interrelated, right? The trust among the crew. I mean, you got to have trust on and off duty. You know, they expect you to show up sober and they also expect you to kind of play by the rules when you go home. And you're not going to get that if you're making mistakes out there like that, if you're abusing it and if you're, you know, doing the wrong thing. But, yeah, great point, I think. And then SISM, too. You know, these guys you work with, you trust. These are people that you party with on the weekends and stuff. If you see something, say something, reach out, help out your shipmate, and don't keep things quiet. Try and talk about it.
Absolutely. Yep.
That was my public service announcement.
That
for the
was good.
Day.
That was really good. I had nothing to add because you hit all the points, Phil.
Yeah, man. I just think it's it's important, especially when you respond to disasters like Ashley
absolutely
did. Because I know for a fact you saw stuff, and I'm sure everybody out there that day, whether you lived through it or you responded to it, definitely saw things that had to have been a challenge.
Well, and I was gonna say, I think the only thing I'd say add on to that is even if you've never been to one of these big disasters that gets on the news, don't let that. If you're having trouble, reach out and talk to somebody. There's somebody who's willing to listen and willing to help you out. everybody's problems are valid. If you've got a problem, there's somebody who wants to help you with it.
Absolutely. And there's no shame in that. You know, actually, it makes you that much stronger of a person to be able to say, you know what, time out, hold on, I need to go get help with this, or, you know, I'm drinking too much, or whatever the case may be. There's no shame in that. And that's what I learned. And it took me a long time to figure that out, because, you know, we all have that pride of like, oh, no, no, I'm good, or I got this, or whatever. And sometimes it's okay to say, you know what, I don't got this, and I need some help.
Yeah, and you're going to grow from it. You know, at the end of the day, I think that's the most, or one of the most important things, is that you grow from it. Yeah. And you can help others, just like you did. I mean, writing this book, you know, you're going to share struggles, successes, and everything, and that people are going to learn from it. And luckily, they get to learn through your mistakes versus their own.
Yeah, we're getting really philosophical here, but I think that's a lot of times the people who have the personality to do what we do, who, you know, we see a hurricane or a boat fire or whatever, and we're like, I'm going to go that direction towards it to try and help people. Those are the people that are probably the least likely to be willing to ask for help, because they feel like they're supposed to be the helpers, not the ones asking, and everybody needs help sometimes.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Man, it was deep. Take a breath.
Yeah, oh, I know. God, I feel like we need a group hug.
Yeah, right?
I'm not hugging Phil.
Solid therapy session.
Phil just got over a cold. I'm sitting like 3 feet from him, and I'm afraid.
Yeah. Ashley, just to end it on a high note, right? Funniest Coast Guard story that won't get anyone in trouble.
Oh, man. Oh, you really are putting me on the spot. I have too many. Every day is like a funny day for me, because I'm like a class clown and I love to make people laugh and joke all the time. Oh, gosh. I can tell you like a prank that was played on me that, okay, so I'll tell you this. It's a pretty funny one. So back in Detroit, when I was a brand new AET, I had a bunch of guys there that were mentoring me, and of course they would pick on me a little bit, and it was all in good fun because we were on the night shift. And if you've ever worked the night shift in aviation, you know it's nothing but, you know, work hard and joke even harder.
You guys are sleeping in Lazy Boys the whole time in the ready room. Don't lie to us.
No, that's the rescue swimmers. The mech section.
Who was it? Was that Pepe that was like, oh, I can hear the plane engines out of my duty room.
Think
like, get out of here. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, anyways, I was on night shift and we were sitting there working hard, and it was the end of the night and I'm getting ready to leave, and I say bye to everybody and I go out to my car, and it's a hot summer day, so I have my windows down and I'm getting that cool breeze, and I hear like click, 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 and I'm like, what in the heck is that noise? Like, it's like 3 a.m. I'm beat tired, and I'm like thinking my truck is going to explode because it's clicking really, really loud. So finally, I pull over on the highway. I look underneath it, and they had zip tied my drive shaft like all throughout the bottom of it. And so they were like, and I was like, "Oh my gosh!" But
so,
I got
so while they were working really hard on the night shift, they had time to zip tie your drive shaft.
Yeah, like I said, work hard, play hard. All right,
it was awesome. That's perfect. Good send off, I think, on the duty day.
Heck yeah. I laughed really hard at that one. I was like, oh, you guys got me good.
I like it. Well, hey, Ashley, so everyone, tell us where we can find your book.
Awesome. Yeah, so my book is now on Amazon. It's The Hurricane Within. There's the ebook and there's the paperback. I'm going to be launching my website here hopefully in a couple weeks. So there'll also be a link on my website, thehurricanewithin.com. And I am actually in the works of getting an audiobook and a hard copy out probably before the holidays, all on Amazon.
Very cool. Awesome. Yeah, please, guys, go out, you know, get Ashley's book. She might sign it for you. She's going to do some book signings. Where's the first one? Do you know yet?
I actually just booked it here in Detroit at a bar called Jamboozies. They were the first bar I worked at, like, back when I was 19 before I joined the Coast Guard. So they offered to host me for my first book signing.
Very cool.
Really cool.
Open invitation to Yorktown. I don't know where we do it, but we'll help you find a place if you ever come down.
I would love that. Absolutely. Hey, sounds like cool. A plan.
Awesome. So, guys, get out there. The Hurricane Within. Make sure you review it right afterwards, because that's what really...
5 stars.
Yep. That's what pops up the sales. You don't even have to read it. Just 5 stars when you buy it.
Yep. Yes.
I don't think you have to buy it. I think you can review it.
Just 5 stars. Yeah, five stars.
Everybody buy it and hit 5 stars.
There you go.
Thanks, guys. What? Yes, that helps.
Ashley, we really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for your years of service.
Right on. Thank you so much, and you too.
Yeah, thanks, Ashley. It was good talking
to you. Thanks for having me.
Yep, good luck with the book.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.